Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, they would make up one of the world's most populous nations, but they're spread far and wide across the globe. We hear why the church and at least one expert look at migrants as an opportunity. And in March, we traditionally reflect on the feminine genius. Today, Dominican Sister Toni Harris offers us a reflection on women in the world and in the church. Italy is a different place today than the one I knew when I first arrived here. Over the last 25 years or so, Italy has gone from a place where a black man or a woman with blonde hair would stand out in a crowd to a multicolored nation with a rising population of Africans, Asians, and Arabs mixing with Italian and other European stock. But Italy is certainly not alone on the receiving end of migration. The Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations in Geneva and its representative to the International Organization for Migration notes that some 250 million people today live and work in a place other than where they were born. Archbishop Silvano Tomasi says, though migration can be seen by local populations as a problem, given the different customs, religions, and traditions migrants bring with them, the Catholic Church sees the phenomenon as an opportunity, particularly as a force for new evangelization.
Migrants have been a reality in the past, and today human mobility is increasing and it has reached the highest number that we know of. There are over 250 million people that work and live in a place different from where they were born. The Church looks at migration in a positive and constructive way. It does not see only the immediate problems that emerge when a new community settles in a country with different habits, different cultures, a language that different that doesn't facilitate communication. It's unavoidable that at the beginning there are some tensions and some problems. But in the long run, it is well documented that migrations are a benefit for the migrants, for the countries of origin of the migrants, and above all, for the country of arrival, where they contribute their work, their intelligence, their talents, and in the long run, they become very productive citizens of these new countries. So there is a human economic benefit, but there is also, I would say, a pastoral and spiritual value that emerges from the experience of migration. We have seen from the very first moments of the history of the Church, when the first Christian community in Jerusalem was persecuted and dispersed, forced to emigrate, that the believers created new communities all over today's Middle East. And today we have similar situations. For example, there are thousands of Filipinos who live in the Gulf states, and they maintain their faith and create new communities, even though they are there only temporarily, in places, in countries where there was no Christian presence before. For example, in Qatar, there is a huge parish in Doha with 3,000 people going to Mass on Sunday. So there is a double approach, I would say, to evangelization in the context of migration. One is what I mentioned, the migrants themselves spreading the faith through their presence and their fidelity to their baptism. And the other is that when non-Christians come into Christian countries or Christian communities, they remind us of the effort of the Church to be missionary. Because in the past we used to send missionaries to Asia, to Africa. Now, when Africans and Asians are coming into a European or an American context where Christianity has been present for a long time, we can say that the missions have come to us. And it's up to the priests, the parishes, the lay Christians to offer the opportunity to the newcomers to know what the gospel is in such a way that the message of Jesus can be an option for a free choice on the part of the newcomers.
You've said that migration is seen by the Catholic Church as an opportunity. However, at the same time, you've also said that Islam poses challenges, particularly in Europe. How so?
12, 13 million Muslims in the European Union as a result of immigration. They have their own faith, their own identity, their own culture, and the lack of separation between church and state that is part of their experience sometimes can create difficulties because they rebuild ethnic communities that are based on the same principle. And this blocks a process of integration into Western democracies.
In other words, their religion is based on the literal reading of the Quran and also of Sharia law.
Yes, their understanding of the message of the Quran and of their religious laws and traditions, this understanding leads them to recreate a form of life that finds it difficult to allow an integration process into European and American or democratic societies. This is one cultural, political dimension that has to be taken into account when one wants to reflect about a religious implication. There is the possibility, of course, to announce the gospel even among immigrants of Islamic tradition, but the first step is to find a way to respect each other, to live together freely, and to contribute together to the building up of a society where the common good prevails. So if we are able to create a context of freedom where every religion can function and articulates, even in a collective and communitarian way, its beliefs, then it is possible to dialogue with Islam and find a way to live together. And this context of freedom will allow individuals from the Islamic tradition to freely choose, if they so like, to freely choose the message of the gospel as their guidance for life.
This is a time when multiculturalism and the actual number of immigrants in Europe is being questioned by political leaders here. You are calling for a globalized response to the migration issue. How so?
The experience of Europe, for example, in England with multiculturalism, has proven of limited value in a way because it has not encouraged integration into the total society, according to some of the observers of the English scene. It is important that the process of integration may develop in a normal, progressive way. In the long run, migration is beneficial, but confronted with this increasing mobility, we see that there is a kind of contradiction, because migration is regulated by national legislation, and countries today have a tendency not to give up their sovereignty, in particular on this point of deciding who can come into their territory, what kind of people, what kind of cultural, new cultures and new religions are arriving. But migration by its nature involves more than one country, the country of origin, the country of transit, the country of arrival are all involved. So there is a need to cooperate and to talk in such a way that the experience of migration may become beneficial for everybody. But to arrive at this collaboration, besides regional forms of dialogue among governments, it seems to me that we are moving in the direction that globalization involves not only the countries more directly affected by movement of people, but all the countries in one way or another. And therefore, it will be useful, even though it is a bit of an ideal wish, to have a body in the world like we have it for trade and we have it for health or other human common necessities, to have a body that could facilitate the management of migration on the world level.
In other words, you were mentioning it could be the International Organization for Migration.
At this point, one structure in the international context that is more suited to carry out this task, because it has over 140 member states that are negotiating and talking with each other and trying to find solutions for migration issues. It could be the beginning of such global management, even though the IOM doesn't have a binding force. It cannot oblige states to do things the way they agree, but it's more and more becoming a point of encounter and of agreement to develop such a global management.
Archbishop Silvano Tomasi is the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations in Geneva. Well, the president of the Migrant Policy Institute, a Washington and Brussels-based think tank, Dr. Dimitrios Papadimitriou, says the economic crisis in countries like his native Greece has led many people to leave the country or consider emigrating in search of a better future. Himself a naturalized U.S. citizen, Dr. Papadimitriou explains that countries in Europe like Greece, Spain, and Ireland, which were once emigrant nations, have seen a reversal in that pattern in the last few decades, with large numbers of immigrants arriving on their shores.
To give you some example, places like Greece and Spain and Ireland, in a decade or decade and a half, had as many immigrants per capita, per head, as the United States has, which is a remarkable statement to be able to make.
Papadimitriou observes that the people who left these countries in the last 70 or 100 years were mostly farmers or poor people from small villages who emigrated to another country seeking better opportunities.
Ultimately, that's what people look for. In the earlier stages, survival, and later on, survival plus opportunity. The sense that they can do better for themselves and for their families by going somewhere else. Now, a new phenomenon has emerged. First of all, those countries that very suddenly became countries of immigration are, in a sense, now returning back to their old norm, and they are becoming, again, significant countries of emigration. But this time, the people who are leaving these countries, my country of origin, of birth, Greece, Spain and Italy, of course, and many of the other places, what they're losing is young, very educated, very dynamic people who are really leaving because they don't think that there are any prospects for them.
Well, if you listen to any of the families, you know, with young kids, most of the ones that I know are really considering sending their kids abroad for college to England or to France or elsewhere, and suggesting that they go look for jobs outside.
And this is happening. And believe me, the interest in talented young foreigners in countries like the United States and the UK and, you know, Australia, Canada, and what have you, is very, very high, because what they see, my country, the United States, sees is an opportunity to actually have young, talented people educated in the United States or Canada or whatever, which means that they know the language, they have become acculturated, et cetera, et cetera, so they can ease into the society rather easily. and also bring in their education and talents to the service of the United States economy and society.
Sure.
That's great for the receiving countries. At some point, it becomes problematic for the sending countries, because in order for them to sort of turn back and go back into a path of economic growth, they need the very talents of the young people that they're losing today.
Countries like Italy and Greece are losing the best and brightest of their academics, scientists, engineers, and health professionals to countries like the United States, which invest heavily in these fields and offer greater financial rewards.
Well, in fact, here in Italy, it is a big debate because so many of the big brains in the scientific and the medical communities are in the United States, and they're earning good money there. So the debate here has been, let's invest more in our young people, invest more in the scientific and medical sectors, just to name two, and get our kids to stay.
And this
it doesn't seem to be doing the trick.
It is not doing the trick. And this is losing the best and the brightest is not a new phenomenon. It has nothing to do with the economic crisis. It has to do with the reward structure, particularly in the United States, the investments that, you know, private endowments and the government, et cetera, make into research laboratories and into creating and maintaining the finest research institutions in just about anything, medical sciences, et cetera, which makes it a no-brainer for an up-and-comer or already an established brain, as you say, to say, okay, you know, I have all the skills here, but I've reached just about my limit. And there are almost endless opportunities over there. So in this instance, it takes two to tango. Mm-hmm. You have to have conditions, you know, in places like Italy, and it happens with Germans and French and, you know, everybody else, who basically say, yeah, I can wait here until I become 50 or 55, you know, and then I become a big professor with my own research lab, and et cetera. Or,
and you're probably only earning about 4,000 euros, if you're lucky, 4,000 euros a month, which would be about $5,000.
And you can go to the United States, you probably can quadruple or, you know, God only knows what the multiplier is. Your income, your reputation sort of goes through the roof. There's plenty of money. You can experiment. And truth be told, a good probability that you're going to get a Nobel Prize, you know, if you do that. So, you know, it's almost a no-brainer.
Right. Well, so what is the answer to stem this immigration for economic reasons? I mean, what has the state got to do, and what do private enterprises have to do with this?
Well, you know, the state can create an environment in which private enterprise can actually have much more flexibility in how it conducts itself in the marketplace. And the state, of course, can make strategic investments. It's something that the United States says that it doesn't, but we do. But in Europe, very explicitly, you know, the governments do that. You know, the French, you know, sort of pick winners, you know, and they try to support them. The Brits, and, you know, appeal to philanthropists and also put money on the table in order to create those research labs, et cetera. This way their best people will stay there. So part of it is to think strategically about what kind of investments you need to make. The second one is to basically change the whole environment about the reward structure. You know, so if you're a very talented person, it makes no difference whether they are 35 or 60. You know, you basically create a system where people who are exceptional at the age of 35 or 40 can sort of get off of that path of $4,000 or euros, etc. And in the United States, sometimes when we're constrained from doing those things, universities, for instance, particularly public universities, can only pay up to a certain salary. But in order to keep or attract super talented people, they take money from their endowment. In other words, from philanthropists or previous graduates that give money to their alma mater, and they supplement that salary. So they still get paid only $6,000, you know, a month, or $8,000 a month as a public employee in a state university, but they can double or triple that from private funds. So these are the public-private partnerships that one hears about, mm-hmm. and perhaps more of those need to happen in mm-hmm. Europe.
So what do you see the role of religion here, or perhaps of the Catholic Church?
Well, you know, certainly the Catholic Church provides the, you know, sort of the infrastructure that argues in favor of how, of treating people properly, you know, of creating, you know, strong families and maintaining strong families, all of which matter. Decisions to emigrate are not nearly as easy as I may make them, you know, sometimes. You know,
because conflict, war, a lot of other reasons contribute to it.
Exactly right. So these are difficult decisions. So the more on this, you know, on the side of staying, you know, the more, you know, variables there are that basically stay here. You know, you have a strong family, you know, you have, you know, a religion that matters to you, you have social institutions that are important to you, etc., etc., and you have a good job and prospects for doing very well in your field. The more you have of these things, the less likely it is that, you know, that the people will emigrate. But the truth is that increasingly we live in a world where people move, and the most talented people move most freely. And what used to be a monopoly of the United States is no longer a monopoly of the United States. We still have prohibitive advantages. But, for instance, the Super Collider, you know, in Switzerland,
sure.
which is a
mm-hmm.
project in which everybody has put money,
CERN,
mm-hmm. CERN essentially attracts the very best physicists mm-hmm. from anywhere, including the United States. So you cannot recreate CERN. You know, it costs hundreds of billions of euros to do that and a long period of time. But the idea that, you know, collectively Europe can create these, let's call them centers of excellence, scientific excellence, whether they happen to be in Italy or elsewhere, the more likely it is that it will keep some of their superstars.
Dimitrios Papadimitriou is the president of the Migrant Policy Institute. In March each year, we remember what Pope John Paul II used to call the feminine genius, the contributions of women to the world. An International Women's Day has been set aside by the United Nations on March 8th each year to mark the economic, political, and social achievements of women. Sister Toni Harris, justice and peace promoter for the Dominican Sisters International, reminds us that at least 750 women have been proclaimed saints or blessed by the Church, which celebrates the lives and contributions of women as witnesses to gospel living.
International Women's Day, originally called International Working Women's Day, is marked on March 8th every year. Although the observance began as a socialist political observance, the day has been celebrated as a popular international event since 1977, when the United Nations General Assembly invited member states to proclaim March 8th as the UN Day for Women's Rights and International Peace. Today, celebrations range from activities to show love and appreciation for women to efforts to acknowledge women's accomplishments in society. Recently, I've been reflecting on this day through the lens of our church. Of course, the church consistently honors Mary, the Mother of God, as the woman who is the primary model for those who would be disciples of Jesus, her son. Many other women have also been raised up for us as witnesses to gospel living. In fact, one online source lists more than 750 women whom the church has publicly proclaimed as saint or blessed. However, in our church's liturgical calendar, the days observed in our Eucharistic liturgy, 144 male saints are celebrated as compared with only 28 female saints. Some local bishops' conferences have added to the calendar, but the number continues to be disproportionate. Benedictine sister Ruth Cox comments that women and men who are looking for spiritual nourishment from the stories of our ancestors, both male and female, are finding that the diet is very meager at the table of the liturgy. We observe this International Women's Day of 2012 during the year that marks the 50th anniversary of the opening of the Second Vatican Council. The pastoral constitution of that council, Gaudium et Spes, or the Church in the Modern World, is important to take up again. Let's consider its relevance to the position of women in our church and society. Dr. Marilyn Marton, a recently retired professor of moral theology at New York's St. John's University, provides us with a thoughtful reflection. She states, "Gaudium et Spes is a pastoral constitution that puts a great deal of emphasis on the dignity of the human person and the solidarity of the entire human family. It encourages us to support this dignity and solidarity in the context of the modern world, to scrutinize the signs of the times, and to interpret these signs in the light of the gospel. It recognizes the shift from a static concept of reality to a more dynamic and evolutionary one, and highlights various concerns that have arisen as a result of this shift. One of the concerns the document highlights is the social relationships between men and women. The Constitution stresses that, quote, every type of discrimination, whether social or cultural, whether based on sex, race, color, social condition, language, or religion, is to be overcome and eradicated as contrary to God's intent. She continues, Gaudium et Spes recognizes discrimination as an evil that is to be overcome and encourages us to work towards the elimination of discrimination. 50 years after the publication of Gaudium et Spes, women around the world are still struggling to be treated with dignity, to be afforded basic human rights, and to live free from the threats of violence and injustice, despite attempts that have been made to legislate rights and protections. Women suffer from systematic discrimination in every country in the world, whether it is through more explicit and violent forms, as in many third world countries and patriarchal societies, or subtler job discrimination and pay inequities that occur in Western societies. Dr. Marton concludes her reflection with this observation. The call of Gaudium et Spes is that a woman must be respected and appreciated. All discrimination against women must end. For this to happen, however, there needs to be a change of hearts, as well as laws, put into place that protect women. I close with a comment from Pope John Paul's letter to the bishops of the Catholic Church on the collaboration of men and women in the church and in the world. He says, "But in the final analysis, every human being, man or woman, is destined to be for the other. In this perspective, that which is called femininity is more than simply an attribute of the female sex. The word designates indeed the fundamental human capacity to live for the other and because of the other." Let us recommit ourselves to continuing efforts to create a world where women and girl children everywhere are respected, appreciated, and honored as human beings created in the image and likeness of God.
And a warm thanks there to Sister Toni Harris, Justice and Peace Promoter for the Dominican Sisters International. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.